You're listening to part 2 of episode 632 of Unwelcome Guests. The film continues to explore what I see as a confluence of moneyed interests, the merging of the government, the police system, schooling system, prison system. These interlocking hierarchies interrelating through money are, as the film demonstrates, showing increasingly little respect for human beings in the system, their welfare, and is increasingly effective at twisting their imagination to its own ends.
Media hysteria really created this groundswell of support for zero tolerance and folks being scared that it could happen in their school. And so now we have police officers in every school. He's now there to be law enforcement. He's there to lock up kids. And when you go into juvenile courtroom and sit there and see, you know, 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds coming in orange jumpsuits, shackled at their ankles and at their wrists, and they have not committed a violent crime, but they're being treated that way, it's shocking. And we really need to step back and think about what we're doing to this generation of kids.
Stratford High School became a international high school in just a few minutes. And it was on TV stations all across the world. There's no doubt in my mind that the intentions of the action that day were pure. And by that I mean school officials and police officials had ample reason to suspect that there was illegal drug activity, all the drug activity, there was drug activity taking place at that particular time of the morning at that particular location in that school. And they had documentation that was a normal occurrence there. And so there was a plan devised, in fact, to try to apprehend those responsible for that.
Well, the raid takes place in the main hallway of the school, and this is where the one surveillance camera is filming. Police kind of swarm in now from the bottom of the screen and jump on top of kids. I mean, it's pretty violent and aggressive.
Put your hands on your head. Secure. Hands on your head.
Hey, this is funny. I don't want to hear no talk.
Within mere seconds, they had the hallway secure. Kids who didn't immediately comply told to, you know, get on the ground repeatedly. If they didn't get on the ground, they were put in those flexi cuffs, and, you know, cops are telling you to get on the ground. Meanwhile, they have their guns pointed the entire time. Ferocious canines, like video straight out of, you know, Birmingham or Selma. It was absolutely horrendous. And I mean, you really get the idea just how frightened these students must have been. I can't imagine how these students felt about it at the time.
Now, how that was conducted, I've been on national television and said, I'm sorry that it happened that way. That was most unusual and to take place in a school building. And I'd never seen anything like that before or since. I don't think we will. So I'm sorry that it happened that way, but I think this does point out that people are trying to figure out how do you stop this terrible disease of drug addiction, and how do you stop it and try to keep one more student from getting involved in it. And that was why I say the intentions were pure. It was trying to stop that.
The problem with what happened in Goose Creek or the use of drug-sniffing dogs in schools in general is, A, it creates a police state atmosphere in the school, no matter how cute and cuddly those dogs may be. And second, it teaches kids the wrong lesson. It teaches them that you are guilty until you are proven innocent. We are going to assume that all of you have drugs, and therefore we have to bring in these drug-sniffing dogs instead of requiring schools to have reasonable suspicion that a particular student has broken school rules or broken the law, and then engage in that sort of intrusive search.
Book bags in the center now. You, your feet will stay still. We'll move the book bags. Right in front of the
wall. And there's a third thing, by the way, that's wrong with these drug-sniffing dogs, and that is they have a really high false positive rate. So often the dogs will alert, and then a student is subjected to a very intrusive search. Somebody's going through their backpack, they have to empty their pockets, their car is searched. When in fact, the dog alerted to the kid's bologna sandwich.
Say yes to your life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no.
Almost anything that you hear is unreal about drugs in terms of who's using drugs, who's abusing drugs, where the problem is, and what ought to be done about it.
Parents refuse to think that it was their kid's choice. They're like, it's peer pressure. It's always the other kid's fault.
It's not peer pressure, because
people aren't going to be like, you have to try it. Because if you don't want to, they're like, all right, nice, more for me. They're not going to force you to do something like that. They don't understand the way things really are.
Well, emergency cases from illegal drugs, heroin, cocaine, meth, all of them, is people over the age of 30. And nobody will discuss this particular issue because it's a taboo topic. It is not permissible to discuss drug abuse as a middle-age problem. So we had this unreal discussion of the group that's really abusing drugs the least, which are teenagers and young adults, being held up as the problem.
There's like two or three different drug groups, because there's DARE, and then there's these one people that give you wristbands that have monkeys on them, but I don't remember who they are, because it just says, don't monkey around with drugs on the wristband. And you got, like, candy if you kept it on all week. So people would, like, hook it to their belt loops and stuff because no one's really going to wear it. We just want the candy. You know, no one really pays attention to it. It's very, yay, we don't have to have class. I think that's the only reason people like when they come is because people can just kind of, I don't have to take my test today. I don't have to turn in my stuff. I have an extra day to do my homework. You know, that's all we're really thinking about when it happens. And it's basically just a day to goof around.
The DARE program has been shown time and time again to not work. It doesn't actually reduce the use of drugs amongst the kids who go through the DARE program, and it doesn't actually cause kids to have attitudes towards drugs that are, say, more, you know, negative than kids who don't go through the program at all.
Studies have found that DARE graduates were more likely to drink alcohol, smoke tobacco, and use illegal drugs than those who did not go through the program. In 2003, the US Department of Education concluded that the DARE program was ineffective and prohibited their use of federal funds. In 2007, President George W. Bush declared April the 12th National DARE Day.
They always very, very off with their terms. Like booze, like drinking stuff, everyone calls it alcohol. That's just all it's called. And they're like, they come up with like 20 different things you can call it. I'm like, what are they talking about? You know, and then all we think about is what they called it and how stupid they sound. And then we're not, obviously not going to listen to them. There's people that try too hard to be adults, and then people that try too hard to communicate to the kids, which doesn't work.
Hey everyone, I'm Retro Bill, your DARE safety buddy. I'm going to take you on an exciting journey through the world of safety. Cool. I'm going to be your guide as you learn the lessons of how to be safe, drug-free, and violence-free. Right on.
I think we have to change, you know, the entire education paradigm where kids aren't just learning, you know, DARE and just say no. You know, seeing 30-second spots on TV, which, you know, studies are proving now get them to think more about drugs and, you know, think about however they feel, whether it's positively or negatively. But, you know, increasingly kids have a pretty positive view of marijuana, given that none of their friends have ever OD'd on it, ever.
These illegal drugs are always bad for you. They can get you into big trouble, get you sick, or even kill you.
Teach kids those, you know, lifelong learning skills that, you know, will actually enable them to make independent choices instead of just going, just say no, just say no.
Kids need to feel safe, not only from other students, but they need to feel safe from the administration and from teachers. And often that's not the case. Teachers are allowed to bully kids. Administrators are allowed to bully kids.
There are some sadistic people out there. There are administrators and there are the specialists that that just seem to enjoy hurting people. And it seems to attract a certain kind of person that maybe was powerless for a long time in their life.
I mean, it's interesting. In schools, you generally end up having about 5% of the teachers responsible for about 90% of the discipline referrals. And what I always found interesting is that the kids always were the ones that were punished. It was always the children's fault.
It was always this blame the student mentality that they seemed to have. They was just this, it's always the student's fault. It's the student's fault. It's like, look, there's adults running this school, not the students. It's the adults that are in charge, not the students. So why is it the student's fault? So they were we were talking about truancies. And
why students don't want to come to school,
that they're, if they're 16 years old and if they're truant, should we expel them, this, that, and the other. And they were talking about, you know, these students are drained on resources, they want to come to school. And at that point, I finally had had enough of this blame the student mentality, and I said, could someone please tell me, has anyone ever delved into the reasons why these children don't want to come to school? And
it was total silence.
What I see is human suffering in front of me every day. 100 kids a day. Out of 100 kids a day, for 60, it's pretty miserable. It's a pretty miserable experience every single day. Being herded around like sheep, being judged by your peers, being called a faggot by people, getting beaten up, low-level harassment by adults, getting screen debt, sitting in horrible rooms, being physically exhausted. Eating horrible food, being treated like an animal.
Can I have your attention, please?
No, not really.
Before we start today, I would like to go over 3 rules for this class. If you follow them, we will all have a lot of fun. If you do not follow them, there will be consequences.
One of the great honorable professions of all time are teaching. Yeah. One of the great tragedies that occurred in America was about 60 years ago when the National Education Association, which was then truly a professional association, like doctors and lawyers and accountants, they decided that it was in their best interest to become an industrial-style union. And they essentially really obliterated the quality of teachers in the United States. There's a significant deterioration of the quality of people in public schools teaching today than there were 50 years ago.
That's what teachers need to be. They need to love kids. They need to love teaching kids. Just too many teachers nowadays are just concerned with having authority over people. They want to become a teacher because they know they control you for the time that you're in there. And that's what most of them want.
I was hoping we could have fun this year, and I think that we still can. But only after you learn to follow all of my rules. And you will follow all of my rules.
I often see this bumper sticker. If you can read this, thank a teacher. And I often thought, well, what about having a counter bumper sticker that would say, if you hate math, thank a teacher. If you think you're stupid, thank a teacher. But school doesn't want to do that. Because, I mean, school refuses to admit that they even do that, that that's a side effect for a lot of people. They just ignore it. But, of course, if they're successful, then, you know, you hear about all the successes. But all the people that are, you know, have turned their anger against themselves or against the school, they're just, oh, it's not our problem, that's yours.
The truth is that most teachers today went to colleges that were not competitive and even there did not do very well.
There are school systems that are taking CEOs out of private industry and people believing that schools are a business, so they need someone with the business sense. Most businesses are trying to produce a product that is exactly the same with certain tolerances. I mean, it looks exactly alike. If they are building Ford pickups, they want them all to look just about alike, maybe a little different paint on them. And human beings, not that way.
If you don't accept the punishments of low grades or of a teacher shouting or standing in the corner or whatever, if you don't accept this discipline, you're systematically humiliated and mocked, and your parents are brought in, and they get a taste of the lash, too.
Parents actually have been taught to believe that if their child's misbehaving, it's not a discipline problem, it's a biochemical problem. The child hasn't learned to read, it's not a teaching problem, it's, again, a biochemical problem, maybe even a genetic problem.
Yeah, that's what I see in the school. It's, if you can't sit down in that chair and keep your mouth shut, it has nothing to do with the fact that this is developmentally inappropriate for children to be expected to do. It's this child has got something wrong with him or her. And if this child can't sit still and seem motivated to these boring, you know, force-fed tasks, we need to drug him or her because there's something wrong with them.
They're often our best and brightest kids. They're our most energetic kids, our most rebellious kids, our most exciting kids, the kids who may someday really transform the world and bring new and better things into the world. Well, those kids are always somewhat difficult. I mean, by definition, they're going to be a little more difficult, require more attention and more guidance and more love maybe than some other children. Well, these are the kids now that get diagnosed. And they're the kids who get drugged.
So I have kids that will come to school some days and just be like, just staring at the ground. I mean, like someone took out the front part of their brain. And almost drooling, kids just passed out. And I'll ask them, what's going on, man? What's up with you? They say, well, I changed meds. You know, I got new meds. I'm adjusting to this.
Why is it that the U.S. has six times as many kids on Ritalin as any other country? Because this is the most profitable country to sell your drugs. Ritalin was originally made by a Swiss company. They couldn't get the Swiss to put their kids on it.
99 times out of 100, it's not a kid who is having a problem learning. Okay, they typically are bright kids, not necessarily, but typically bright kids that we're medicating. They are definitely energetic kids, kids that question, kids that argue with teachers. Big no-no, don't argue with teachers, don't argue with the source of wisdom, don't argue with administrators. And we are lobotomizing these kids.
The markup is here. I heard a paper about a year ago. There were, in all of France, there were only 8,000 kids on Ritalin and similar substances. In Lansing, Michigan, I'm sure we have many more than 8,000 kids on it. It's been an enormous marketing coup.
I think the question we have to ask, though, is this really 4 million kids that we're talking about? If you're talking about it's a temporary condition or a very few small number of people, you might be able to make a case, but not 4 million. 4 million children and teenagers do not need Ritalin. They don't need these psychiatric drugs that we're seeing. And again, we have to ask, why the United States? Why do we account for 90% of all Ritalin prescriptions in the world?
There's virtually hardly any independent voice in regard to the effects of psychiatric medication. It's the voice of the industry that you hear, no matter who's speaking.
There has been an enormous increase in marketing. We have direct TV advertising. We have the drug companies spend over $10,000 per doctor in the United States to push their products.
The only thing a psychoactive agent can do to a child's brain is disrupt it. That's why we're against having kids drink alcohol and smoke cigarettes. It's why we have very strict punishments for selling illegal drugs to children. Because we have a sense that there's something that should be inviolable about the growth and development of the child's brain. Yet we put toxins into their brains at extraordinarily high concentrations in the name of psychiatric treatment. So that our children's brains literally grow up adapting to a bath of toxicity. Now, often the initial psychiatric drug is the beginning of a lifelong dependence on psychiatric drugs. The child will never become free.
What the medications typically do for almost everything, whether it's ADHD or depression or schizophrenia, is they improve the symptoms in the short run.
and they make the patients more likely to be chronically disabled.
And that's the method of addiction, and that's why we are actually bringing up our kids to be psychiatric or street drug addicts when we give them these kinds of drugs as children. When you disrupt the brain in children, they become more apathetic, they become more docile, and they are more controllable for a while. Invariably, however, then their brain starts to fight back against the drugs, and often, if not really most of the time, the children become much worse because now their brain isn't functioning as well. They have less discipline, they have less self-control, they're less in touch with their feelings, they care less about other human beings, all the things that happens to people on drugs.
I think the most obvious effect is that zombie-like state that children get in when they start taking a stimulant. One of the things that I notice is that over the summer, a lot of the parents take their children off the stimulant. And over the summer, I feel like the children come back. You know, they're in my office and they're happy, they're giggly, they want to play, they're playful, they smile. And then in September, they come into my office and their affect is flat. You know, they don't want to do anything. They're apathetic. Hey, you want to go out and shoot some hoops? No. You know, I just immediately notice the child is taken out of them. It's like the spark's turned off. Some children can handle those conditions, and they're the kids that teachers like. They're the teacher's pets. They're the quiet, subdued, compliant children. Those are the children that they hold all the other children up as a standard of how you're supposed to act.
Harvey is the happiest boy in school. He likes to visit with his friends and say hello to everybody he passes. The other children and the teachers, too, like Harvey, because being cheerful helps to make everyone feel better.
I'm actually not ADD. They thought I was because I'm just a little bit crazy, but I'm not. All it did was kind of get me high, I guess. It didn't really help. It's supposed to help me, but I feel normal without it, and I don't know, I hear it's not very good.
The stimulants cause depression, they cause anxiety, they cause obsessive-compulsive disorder. They stunt growth. Do not let the doctors lie about this. NIMH has just done a big study. They, for 4 or 5 years, withheld the data, and finally they let the data slip out from their latest study that the children are having loss of height and weight, not just weight. Now, how does this occur? The stimulants disrupt growth hormone rhythms. Growth hormone doesn't just control height and weight, it controls the entire growth of the body. Hardly anyone addresses that. So we're disrupting the growth of all the organs of the body, including the brain, by giving stimulants to our kids.
Stimulants flood the brain with dopamine. And if you keep doing that over time, the brain is going to stop producing that because it's trying to compensate for all this flood of dopamine. So what happens is the brain stops producing it and you become depressed. So that's another effect, is these children start showing signs of depression.
One of my friends, he his mom caught him doing drugs once, and then his grades were really bad, so she assumed that there had to be something wrong with him. And so they did a bunch of tests on him and diagnosed him with ADD and put him on Ritalin, and now he's like extremely skinny and he doesn't eat right and he throws up, and it's just totally, totally screwed him up, and his grades are even worse.
The kids never learn better, you know, they kind of scrawl their names, you know, they kind of get halfway through assignments and they lose their energy from it. And these are kids that used to be vivacious and energetic, you know, and bouncing off the walls and used to have a ton of opinions. Now they just sit there and stare at the floor, you know, so whose problem's getting solved there?
They can start showing signs of psychosis or nervous tics or Tourette's-like tics where they're constantly touching their face or moving their face. I worked with one little boy once that he became so consumed in nervous tics that he couldn't even go public without people staring at him.
And sometimes these tics become permanent. I remember a very handsome college student who came to me and his face was twitching. He'd been off Ritalin for years and years. He had a permanent twitch from these drugs.
Kids have to be put on more and more medication because of the side effects of the medication, and they're thinking it's the child's mental illness. And the parents are not educated. The parents go to these doctors and these psychiatrists and pediatricians thinking they're getting expert information, and really what they're getting is information that's just been handed down by the pharmaceutical companies and groups like CHAD, which is a parents' organization to support the diagnosis of ADHD. They promote this ADHD fiasco.
Well, there's an enormous irony that we went from having a national campaign of just say no to drugs to a national campaign of just say yes to the very same drugs when prescribed by a physician. It's as if the writing of the prescription somehow changes the basic quality and impact of the drug when it does not. We now have follow-up studies showing that the routine use of Ritalin causes an increased use of cocaine and cigarettes in young adulthood.
For the sake of our children, I implore each of you to be unyielding and inflexible in your opposition to drugs.
The definition of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is really a collection of behaviors that annoy teachers and require attention. This is from the Official Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's put out by the American Psychiatric Association. It is the source of the diagnosis for ADHD. Number one symptom is often fidgets with hands or feet or squirms in seat. The second one is often leaves seat in classroom. The third one is often runs about or climbs excessively, often blurts out answers before questions have been completed, often has difficulty awaiting turn, often fails to give close attention to details or makes careless mistakes in schoolwork, often has difficulty sustaining attention in tasks or play activities, often doesn't seem to listen when spoken to directly, often loses things necessary for tasks or activities, e.g. toys, school's assignments, pencils, books. These are diagnoses to control classrooms. So literally, educators, psychologists, psychiatrists got together and they developed a concept that behaviors that require attention in the classroom shouldn't be given attention, the children should be labeled. Well, the teacher knows is that one out of her 30 kids is doing this or two out of 30 is doing that. And now she's been taught in a seminar, which she doesn't know is presented by a drug company-sponsored doctor, and tells her that that's not her fault. She's not got to learn how to get everybody's attention. She's got a diagnosis she can work with instead.
You can understand a teacher in a class of increasingly crowded classes today that we have 30 or 40 that they don't want to pay attention to one kid or two kids that are causing a lot of problem. So schools are a big recommender of psychiatric drugs for kids, and sometimes will not even let kids come to school unless they're put on some kind of medication.
Boys and girls, how would you like to show some of the ways we know of being quiet?
Yes!
All right, bring your chairs up.
Oh, moving chairs will certainly be noisy. Well, there is a quiet way to move chairs, isn't there? There wasn't much noise at all. No one was disturbed.
This little paragraph tells us that we've forsaken our kids, that we will subject them to boring, repetitive, monotonous, this is their words, repetitive, monotonous situations by diagnosing and drugging them. And we won't provide them close supervision, appropriate rewards for behavior, novelty, or even, quote, interesting activities. What kind of disease? Do you think multiple sclerosis goes away when you have an interesting activity? You think your brain tumor goes away when you're in a novel situation? This is not a disease. This is a condition of teachers, parents, and psychiatrists more than it is a condition of our children. This diagnosis tells you much more about us than about the children.
I don't know what the hell it's doing in their brains, but it is making a formally questioning child turn into a completely complicit child. And that's quite a trick to do to a human brain. I don't know how it works, but it works.
And remember, there's a country called England. They're hardly a third world country. They have banned the use of these drugs with kids and adolescents for two reasons. The first is that they're not very effective with kids. There's never been any evidence that they work with kids. That hasn't prevented us from putting tens of thousands of kids on these drugs because the drug companies have basically lied to doctors. Number two, they dramatically increase suicide and murder.
A disturbing new study out today shows a sharp jump in the number of young Americans committing suicide. Almost 2,000 young people aged 19 and under killed themselves in 2004. That's an increase of more than 18% in the rate of teen suicide from the year before.
Well, when you cause brain dysfunction in a human being, it often leads to suicidal or violent behavior. We now know from clinical trials, and the FDA has admitted that the antidepressants cause suicidal behavior in children. I've been saying it for 10 years. The FDA has finally acknowledged it this year. But the same process also produces violence. Suicide and violence are cut from the same cloth, and they both come from causing brain dysfunction and disinhibition and a lack of self-control in kids. And Eric Harris, probably the leader of the shootings at Columbine, was definitely taking Luvox. I was a medical expert in two cases in Columbine, so I've had access to data, and it's very clear that on autopsy, Eric Harris had an effective level of Luvox in his blood. Now, if you just look at the label for Luvox, which is an adult antidepressant that got marketed to children for obsessive-compulsive disorder, but it's basically an adult antidepressant, and if you look at the label for Luvox, it tells you that in their small study of children, 4% of them became manic on this drug. And mania is this potentially violent, out-of-control behavior. And I know that Eric Harris developed his severe disorder, his violent, hateful, destructive attitudes while taking this drug. That is very clear from his history. And it's clear that he took the drug probably on the very day he committed these acts because he had a significant level in his bloodstream. And the drug, you know, has a half-life of only about a day, less than a day.
A disturbing number of recent young shooters were either on antidepressants or were withdrawing from antidepressants. 12-year-old Christopher Pittman on Luvox and withdrawing from Paxil when he killed his paternal grandparents. 14-year-old Elizabeth Bush on Prozac when she blasted away at fellow students in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, wounding one. 18-year-old Jason Hoffman on Effexor and Celexa when he opened fire at his California high school, wounding five. 15-year-old Sean Cooper on a mix of antidepressants when he shot at students at his Idaho high school. 15-year-old TJ Solomon also on a mix of antidepressants when he aimed his shotgun at classmates in Conyers, Georgia, wounding six. And 17-year-old Eric Harris on Luvox when he and his partner Dylan Klebold killed 12 classmates and a teacher at Columbine.
Education is under siege by the marketeers. It's under siege by the corporations. It's under siege by the evangelicals, you know, who want to promote, you know, abstinence and want to eliminate sex education. I mean, it's under siege by conservatives who really believe that the ultimate test of learning is testing. It's under siege in ways that suggest that teachers are being incredibly de-skilled because all they learn about now is learning how to teach for the test. It's under siege that all the support services are being eliminated. And it's under siege in a sense that it's no longer seen as really fundamental to a democracy itself. I mean, it's actually seen as an excess.
If students go to school in an atmosphere in which school officials get to control what they read, what they say, and what they can put in their school newspaper, they're going to grow up thinking, well, gee, that's the way it is. And when they become adults and government tries to control what they read, what they say, or what they put in their newspaper, they're going to shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's the way it is. And that's how we lose our freedoms.
This institution wasn't created to make sure that every child reaches his full potential, learns as much as there is to learn. Quite the opposite. It was created to get people to stop thinking, frankly. We're supposed to control their thoughts. What other is a prison doesn't even do that, you know? Prison, you're constricted to a room, you know, and you're constricted in all sorts of ways, but no one's telling you what to think.
Nothing seems okay anymore, you know? If you're in school, if you're in summer, you're like, oh man, you're like so free and you're happy and everything's fun. And then you go to school
and nothing is good anymore. You feel like there's no reason to live for.
Public schooling is the antithesis to democracy. We live in a democratic society. Our society is built on freedoms and personal liberties. And yet, it's like we take our children and we lock them up in a prison for 13 years of their life. And we regiment every aspect of their physical body, their emotions, their social contacts, and most importantly, their minds, what they can and can't learn and how they will learn it. And then when they're 18 years old and we open the key and we release them into society, suddenly they're now supposed to know how to think for themselves and be self-starting, innovative, creative, imaginative individuals who are supposed to take part in a democratic process. It's impossible. It'd be like sending the kids over to a fascist nation for 13 years and having them come back and explain what democracy is all about. And yet that's what we do each and every generation since compulsory schooling was instituted in the 1800s.
My curriculum comes from the state. That what is taught is decided at the state level now. That was different 20 years ago, 25 years ago when I was a kid, but now it's decided by the state. And in there, you will not find anything that is critical of governments, of institutions, and I teach history.
If you wanted to simplistically say, what is the one purpose of schooling? It's to psychologically indoctrinate people into their proper social class, their proper relation to authority, their laboratories of psychological indoctrination. Everything else is trivial.
There was no research study that said compulsory schooling works. You know, that putting all the kids the same age in the same classroom at the same time and teaching the same thing but from the same teacher is the best way to learn. There's no research that supports that, but we just threw it in 1850. We said, yeah, that's it. And then, you know, living with that, you know, that's become the norm. It's like, no, the norm should be what, you know, how did Shakespeare learn? Well, some people, oh, well, he went to school. He went to school 12 weeks out of the year.
What never seems to get criticized is the basic institution itself that just keeps churning out tens of thousands of kids who can barely squall out their own name. I got 100 kids a day. If I spent 5 minutes with every kid, that's 500 minutes. I don't have that many minutes at school. It's built into the structure of the school to not spend quality time with the kids.
Whoever managed this in its various manifestations, this system, had a target in mind, and the target was to infantilize the mass mind, to condition it, to indoctrinate it, but basically to condition it to take orders in a docile fashion. Or if an individual felt rebellious, he or she would lack the information and the practice to effectively be rebellious.
The school day actually starts when the alarm rings in the morning, because the child's day is actually consumed the minute they wake up, because they've got to get ready for school. And usually that whole routine is a nightmare for a lot of parents, because they're trying to get the kid up. The kid doesn't want to get up. You know, they're not motivated. Who would want to get up and go to prison? Parents trying to get everything going. Sometimes there's other kids, there's chaos. Parents got to get to work. School's just a big babysitting factory. Sit in their little designated chairs and basically sit down and shut up.
There is absolutely no justification for the sequence of subjects in any school in the country. There is no justification. And by following one by another, you confuse people and bewilder them. All that's left behind is the need to do well on the test. Let's, for the sake of argument, say that you are finally caught up in the wonder, the glamour of quadratic equations. A bell rings. Everyone clears out. The teacher says, come on, you'll be late for your next class. You say, I'm lost in the magic of quadratic equations. I want to finish this. You can't finish. Why not? I don't know why not. Because you have to go and think poetically. And then when you're lost in the rapture of an Italian sonnet and just about to come up with that tricky missing rhyme, the bell rings and somebody says, you have to go take off your clothes and run around a filthy gymnasium and have people scream at you. If you wanted to invent a mechanism to drive people insane, I mean literally insane, so they don't follow their own best interests or their own good common sense, that's the system you would invent.
How late are we?
Five minutes late.
Oh,
sorry.
Thank you.
You internalize something about this process of, you know, the bell rings and you do math. The bell rings and you do English. The bell, you know, you internalize this lesson that I won't learn anything unless it's taught to me. We're seeing that people are graduating from school. They're certified as educated. They have 5 years of French, for instance, or 3 years of trig, stuff like that, and they can't speak French, they can't do trig, and so therefore education is not the same as learning.
They're taught to hate reading by being forced to read stuff that they don't want to, constantly. It's really rare for a kid in school to be able to choose a book that they want to read and read it, and occasionally you get punished for doing that. If you or luck out and you get a teacher that gives you, lets you choose what you want to read, you're going to have to dissect it, you're going to have to write about it, you're going to have to parse it out, you're going to have to, the joy is going to be killed. We're going to atomize this experience, we're going to divide this book up, and we're going to make you hate it, this book you love. By the time you're done with it, and by the time I've given you all the assignments about how to analyze, you're going to hate this book.
Good people wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. They don't read Moby Dick as they wish to. They wait for a teacher to tell them what to read, when to read it, what it means, and then they're assigned questions to answer that control the range of what you can think about in Moby Dick. It's not the way big minds are created.
I'm going to tell you what to write about. Again, the knowledge comes from somewhere else. The motivation comes from somewhere else. I'm going to tell you what to write about and tell you how long it's going to be. I'm going to tell you what kind of cursive writing it should be in. I'm going to tell you your writing's bad, your spelling's bad. I'm going to judge you every step of the way. And then I'm going to get upset because you don't want to write.
You know, if you have to sit through 6 hours of school, at least make it fun. Like, you ask if you could go to the bathroom, for God's sakes, and they just say no.
The overwhelming amount of mail that I get, email I get, is from parents and children desperate to get some help with school teachers who are not letting their children use the toilet when they need to. Either they're restricting it, or they're punishing children for using the toilet, or they're rewarding children who don't use the toilet, or they are outrightly torturing children. What adult would tolerate that? What adult would tolerate at work being told you cannot go to the bathroom? You'd immediately have a lawsuit on your hands, like Nabisco. Nabisco actually had some lawsuits against it because it was not letting factory workers use the bathroom. And that immediately stopped when they brought a lawsuit against it.
Would you go to an office or a club full of gloom? Would you willingly go to a place day after day that depressed you? That made you feel unwelcome because there wasn't room for you?
Certainly not.
Why, no. Then we shouldn't expect our children to either.
Get them in the room. Get them into the room. You know, don't let them out. He said, no free time. No free time. No time to themselves. You know, no time to develop relationships with each other. No time to have conversations. So they get hustled to their rooms. You know, teachers are waving signs, you know, get to class. And you know, they're out in the hall getting yelled at. And they're getting screamed at. You know, all the teachers are ordered to be in the halls during these passing times. So they're getting screamed at to go to class. You get in class, boom, doors shut, quiet, halls are empty. Gotta have a hall pass to leave. If you don't have that hall pass, you're gonna be in trouble. Then you got about 50 minutes direct instruction, sitting in a chair, surrounded by your peers, and ding dong, on to the next class. You know, so you were in social studies, history, let's say, ding dong, drama. Hustle across the school with all your stuff, you know, bounce off of a million people, and now you're in drama. 50 minutes later, ding dong, on to the next. We've got 4 minutes, and you've got to get across the school that's about a quarter of a mile long. Got to hustle to the next one. So you go through this until lunch. Finally, lunch. Thank God, lunch.
They talk about, you know, school phobia. Some kids don't want to go to school. This is a new illness. Not new. It's been around about 10 years now. School phobia. Well, yeah, we talk about prison phobia or concentration camp phobia. I mean, who wants to go to a place where your thoughts and actions are controlled all day?
Children don't have any say in being able to debate the validity of the curriculum. They can't say, you know what, teacher? I heard otherwise. Or you know what? This is my opinion. Or this is my thought. Or wait a minute. I read a book that told me something different. If you do that, you know, I'll see you after school, mister. Your name's on the board. One more outburst like that, and you're mine after school today.
My favorite phrase is because I said so. What kind of answer is that? That's not any reinforcement there. That's like, do it or else.
You know, anywhere from about maybe 8 o'clock to 5 or 6 o'clock at night, the kid's brain and physical body is owned by the school, is owned by the institution. If they're not at school, they're at home doing homework from school, if they care at all about their grades and stuff. You know, and then, boom, you collapse and you're exhausted. You're a 14-year-old, so now you watch TV like any sane, normal person would do to try to relax.
I think that what's important to understand is that parents will completely overlook the conditions their children are in 7 to 8 hours a day. I think parents forget how much of their child's life each day, each week, is literally stolen from them by this institution. And then, after being in school for 7 hours a day, these same children are expected to go home on their own time now and do homework.
I think most parents are familiar with the frustration and exhaustion that are attendant on homework, the family wars, you know, the nagging, the conflict, the fact that kids don't have enough time to do stuff they care about, and most disturbingly, the fact that kids may lose interest in learning itself, come to see it as a chore, along with the homework that they despise and just want to get through. But most parents assume it's all worth it, you know? They assume that it helps kids learn better, raises achievement, teaches them good study skills, and that's why they put up with it and don't complain. What I found in researching the homework myth is it's mostly pain with no gain. I found three things in particular. One, no study has ever found any academic benefit to doing homework before high school. None. In fact, there's not even a correlation between achievement, even by standardized measures, and doing homework or doing more homework. Second, even at high school, there is a weak correlation between test scores and homework, but there's no proof that the homework caused the higher test scores. And in fact, even the correlation falls apart when you use more sophisticated statistical techniques. And third, the idea that there are non-academic advantages, that homework builds character, promotes self-discipline, teaches kids good work habits, is essentially an urban myth.
Don't get me wrong, Marion's a wonderful kid. But she seems awfully quiet lately. I think she studies too much. I can remember kids like that back in school. And it seems to me they were always the ones who didn't seem quite to fit in with the others.
I'm a strong believer in homework. I'm only a strong believer in homework where homework reinforces the learning that happened that day. If homework is not correlated directly to the learning and the accomplished learning of that day, then it's a waste of time.
Mother, may I be excused? I have some homework to do.
Yes, but take your dishes to the sink and save me some work.
I think kindergarten, you could certainly have homework if there's if you are applying what you've learned and you're reinforcing what you've learned.
What is homework? We do work at school, not at home. It's that simple. 20. I can't even stand doing homework anymore. I do a little bit of it and then like don't even complete it and I'm like, screw this, then I turn it in because it's so hard and time consuming, it's annoying.
You know, kids hate homework by and large. There are exceptions with an assignment here and there or a child here and there. But most kids at best see it as something to be gotten out of the way as fast as possible. But the adults tend to shrug their shoulders and say, well, of course the kids hate it. That doesn't matter. Why would their preferences count? And when you stop and think about it, the assumption that homework is going to help, regardless of how the kids feel, is basically a way of saying that kids are like vending machines, where you put more homework in and you get more achievement out. And that's a painfully naive view of how learning happens and a painfully disrespectful way to treat children.
Kids are burnt out on having their minds force-fed facts all the time and being told what they have to do and what they should be doing and never having it asked of them. What are your opinions? What are your curiosities? What are your hopes, dreams, needs, wants?
You hear the word socialization used frequently. That's what schools do best. They socialize children. No, they don't. You learn to talk to a fragment of people your own age. You learn to envy, resent, and fear people older than you. And you learn to have contempt for people younger than you. They hardly exist.
This is what I hate most about school. Preps and jocks.
Preps aren't that bad.
Preps aren't as bad as the jocks, but they're bad. They own the school. Teachers purposely give the jocks better grades so that they can keep playing their sport or whatever it is, so that they can keep the school spirited.
Look at the camera or something, Austin.
Sorry. And it's just stupid because if one group of people own the school, then how is there ever going to be equality at all? Because the jocks hate everybody but the preps.
For some reason.
And the cheerleaders.
The cheerleaders.
The jocks and the cheerleaders that own the school.
Because of the oppressive setting of school, children are forced to go underground and form social units or cliques in order to gain some level of power in their lives and power over the oppressive situation. So what that sets up is severe lack of tolerance for anybody who doesn't wear the right clothes, have the right hairstyle, have the right gadgets. You have some children that just naturally are popular for whatever reason. Either they have got exceptionally good looks or their parents are in high positions or they're rich. And then you have some children that for whatever reason, they just, no matter where they go, they're considered the losers. It could be because of their appearance. It could be a number of other things. And then there's kids in the middle who might always struggle to fit in somewhere in some group, and they have to work really hard to do that.
Popularity, what is it made of? How does a person get to be popular with lots of people and have a few close friends, too? Let's watch and see what makes people like one person and not another.
Hey, Jerry, there's that new girl in our math class. Oh, yes. Her name's Carolyn Ames. She's a swell kid.
Why? Do you know her?
Not very well. I wish I did. I don't know what it is, but there's something about her you like.
Well, she always looks nice to start with.
Yeah, especially when you compare her with some of the weird characters in this play.
That's what the socialization consists of. It consists of some children getting daily harassed and harassed and harassed to the point where they are feeling suicidal and homicidal. And it seems to them that the only way to get through the day may be through violence. That's socialization in schools. Socialization in schools is, if you don't have the right product name on your clothes, if you're not wearing the right clothes the right way, you're a loser. Children are supposed to technically be in school to learn, but really, in order to keep your head above the water socially, you literally have to put out so much mental energy into looking cool, being cool at all times if you want to fit in. If not, if you're a loser in school, your life is hell. You won't make it.
It is fundamental, built in to the system, to the structure, to have kids fail. Fail in terms of learning things, fail in terms of becoming a whole person. It's built into the system. So to say, how do you improve that? You can't improve it. It doesn't want to improve.
Just like our parents complained and the parents before them complained, teenagers act odd. But imagine teenagers at a high school acting so strangely that the Center for Disease Control is called in. And what they found was incredible. Mass twitching.
It acts like a teen repellent. The mosquito produces a high-frequency, highly annoying sound aimed at the eardrums of people between the ages of 13 and 25.
Police in New Jersey now have access to a live video feed of what's happening inside schools.
Moss Park Elementary student describes the 11-year-old's appearance moments after she was tased by a resource officer.
I saw her in the corner, handcuffed, crying.
There goes the airbag!
Yeah! A two-way camera in the rearview mirror records sudden moves like blowing a stop sign or taking a curve too fast. Then it sends an email, and the video to a website just for the parents.
The criminal.
Yeah.
A three-year-old girl.
Scofflaw.
She pulled leaves off a tree at a new waterfront park in Chelsea. How dare you?
School officials say they've tightened their grip on kids showing PDA or public displays of affection.
Oh! Oh! This body slamming incident caught on cell phone video. It was taken inside a Lake County classroom. One of these guys is the teacher.
Eighth grade students with what appears to be a cross burned into his forearm. The student complained of blistering red welts that lasted for weeks after he was allegedly branded by his teacher.
So she duct taped them on their way to school because she thought that they weren't listening to her and following the rules. Let's hear about from this mother who found out that her son was duct taped on the way to school.
You're just a bad kid. You're mean to me, so I get to be mean to you. You're a stupid kid. I swear to God.
A 14-year-old boy found with an arsenal of weapons held in custody, plotting a massive Columbine-style attack.
They are out of control. Teens attacking teachers, fighting, hazing, and beating each other to a pulp.
The list includes 15-year-old Kip Kinkle withdrawing from Prozac when he shot 22 classmates, killing two, after murdering his mother and stepfather at his home in Springfield.
A lot of kids in this country are being over-medicated. One was recently over-medicated to death.
Welcome back, everyone. A new study out shows a shocking increase in the number of children in Florida taking antipsychotic drugs. According to the report, the number of kids taking these powerful drugs has increased 250% in the last 7 years. There isn't much research on long-term effects.
If your child was diagnosed with anxiety or depression, what would you do? Many children are taking antidepressants to deal with those conditions, but for some kids, the pills can actually make things worse.
Our beautiful little girl, Candace, died by hanging 4 days after ingesting 100 milligrams of Zoloft.
Matt violently and with great difficulty took his own life.
She ended the night by cutting her wrist.
Matthew Smith took Ritalin from age 6 to the day he died at age 14. After an autopsy, the medical examiner's conclusion was that Matthew's heart had been damaged by long-term use of methylphenidate, the generic name for Ritalin.
That's what mocks the war on kids. I think that what's taking place is that we have an educational discourse that's become dominant in shaping educational policy and practices that's really about controlling kids rather than investing in them. It's really about containing them rather than supporting them. That's really about making them silent and drugging them rather than listening to them. When any form of behavior that isn't utterly adaptive is now treated with a medical prescription or with a police, viewed as a police infraction, clearly something is tipped over, right? And we've crossed some kind of line where the only way in which we can deal with students is to either treat their problems as a medical problem or to treat their problems as a criminal practice. I mean, is there something missing from this picture?
Excuse me for interrupting, boys and girls, but maybe you would like to find out just what it would be like if there were no rules.
But how could we do that?
By going someplace where there are no rules.
You'd have to go someplace where there are no teachers or policemen or anybody else to tell you what to do.
There's no such place.
You're right.
You still catch me napping one day.
This show and all previous episodes are available from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguest.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes and a mailing list for discussion of future episodes. If you've got feedback or ideas for the show, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguest.net. Theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Willie Depp.